Scripture this morning comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24 through chapter 10 and verse 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning at verse 24. Do you not know that those who run in the stadium race all run, but one gets the prize? You are to run like that so that you may get the prize. Now, everyone who enters an athletic contest brings himself under control in all things. Now they do it, indeed, to get a perishable crown, but we do it to get an imperishable crown. I, indeed, do not run aimlessly, nor do I fight as one who beats the air, but I pound my body and I bring it into submission, lest somehow, having preached to others, I might prove to be unapproved. For I do not want you to be ignorant, brothers, that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all got themselves baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they kept drinking from the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we should not be ones desiring evil, even as they desired it. Don't become idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to party. Nor go committing immorality, as some of them committed immorality, and there were fell in one day 23,000. And don't put Christ to the test, as some of them tested him and were destroyed or were perishing by the serpents. Don't go on complaining, as some of them complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things took place for them as examples, but they were written down as warning for us, upon whom the ends of the ages has come. So then, let the one who thinks he stands watch out, lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to man, but God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able to bear, but he will make with the temptation also the way out, namely the ability to bear it. I know I told you months ago, perhaps, of a situation I noticed in Time magazine back about 1977. I suppose it caught my fancy because we were about to move to Jackson, Mississippi at that time, and this happened to take place in Jackson, one of those unusual episodes where the streets were slippery and treacherous. There was some snow that fell there, and a fellow who was driving a milk delivery truck had pulled up at a residence, and the person who lived there warned the driver, said, "Better be careful, you know, about driving around on these streets. They sure are treacherous." And the driver, of course, condescended to tell the homeowner, "Well, you know, I'm from Illinois, and we're used to this sort of thing." With which, he got back into his truck, drove down the street, and proceeded to plow into a parked car. There's that sort of arrogance of, "I can handle this." And that was the sort of thing that some of the saints at Corinth seemed to be suffering from, a sort of a Christian arrogance, if there is such a thing. They thought, well, we are advanced, we are knowledgeable, we have made much growth, we have seen a lot of video teaching tapes put out by good Christian teachers, we've listened to sermon tapes, we send some of our kids to Christian schools, we go to seminars by Gothard and Dobson and the whole nine yards, and we really think we're rather advanced, we kind of know where we're going, we're informed, and out of that, they kind of apparently got the idea that that they could handle the Christian life, and there wasn't too much that could surprise them or trip them up. They even thought, in their particular case, that as Christians, they could go back and go into those social situations where they would go to dinners in pagan temples and so on, and that they could still do it without being affected by that, being sucked back into paganism or into the immorality that often went along and the orgies that went along with those occasions. You could go ahead and do it, that somehow it wouldn't affect them and their faith. And so they kind of had this idea that that was pretty open and shut. There wasn't much conflict or struggle for them. And so the apostle, as he goes on to answer their questions and their concerns, tries to strike at this attitude. And in chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, he in part says, you know, you need to realize that persevering and enduring faithfully in the Christian life just isn't a matter of, it's just not an automatic thing. It requires a discipline and a vigilance. He says it's like those Isthmian games that you hold at Corinth every 2 years, wherein if the athletes participate, they undergo a rigorous 10-month regimen of putting themselves in shape and denying themselves in order to get ready for those games. And they do all that for just a withered crown of celery if they win. Now, Paul says there's a sense in which the Christian life is like that. There's a discipline, there's a vigilance, there's a rigor about it, and you need to be on your guard. You don't stand steadfast in the Christian life under temptation and onslaught without effort, and so on, and he's trying to get that across to them. And so his point mainly is, if you want to take chapter 10, verses 1 to 13 as a whole, the thrust he's trying to get across to them could be summarized in the words of Jesus to his disciples. Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. That's Paul's word for Corinth. That's Paul's word for Asquith today. Watch and pray that you not fall into temptation. And the two main contentions that he makes are found at the conclusion of his discussion here in verses 12 and 13 when he says, so then, he's summarizing the teaching. So then, let the one who thinks he stands watch out lest he fall. No temptation has taken you except what is common to man, but God is faithful, and so on. What are those contentions? What is he trying to tell you? He is trying to say, first of all, some of you need to be afraid. Some of you need to be afraid. Verse 12. So then, let the one who thinks he stands watch out lest he falls. He was trying to get at this attitude of Christian cockiness that some of the Corinthians had, that they could engage in just about anything, allow them themselves any liberty, and it would never affect their real faith and so on. It would never get to them. It would never destroy them. It would never bring them under God's judgment and that sort of thing. Now, how did he go about that? Well, let me just try to underscore that. In fact, we might say, what was their thinking among the Corinthians that seemed to make them think they had a certain immunity from falling into disastrous sin or unfaithfulness? They seem to have a magical view of the sacraments. That seems to be what Paul is getting at in the first part of chapter 10 when he starts talking about Israel. You say, well, Paul, why take us back into Exodus 14 through 17? Why drag us through all that stuff? But he does. And you'll notice that he keeps repeating the word all, referring to all the Israelites. He says, all of our fathers were under the cloud. All of them passed through the sea coming out of Egypt. All of them were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All of them drank the same spiritual or ate the same spiritual food. All drank the same spiritual drink. But with most of them, God was not pleased. Verse 5. What's Paul saying? He's saying, look, you folks at Corinth, and see, I think he uses these words where the Israelites were baptized into Moses in order to spring the minds of the Corinthians. And he talks about Israel eating the supernatural food in the desert and drinking the water that was supplied, the eating and drinking, the baptism, the eating and drinking, to bring to mind baptism and the Lord's Supper, which seemed to be what the Corinthians were so focused on, that in a wrong sense. They looked upon them as sort of the means by which they were made immune to temptation or to sin. As if they said, well, you see, I have been baptized, I have been united to Jesus, that's the sign of my being united to Jesus, nothing can touch me now. And saying, why, we have the Lord's Supper, and we eat the bread, and we drink the cup, and I partake of Christ, and I seek Him, and I'm in Christ, Christ is in me, and there's something about these sacraments that make us put a shield around us. There was an overconfidence in just the fact that they partook of the sacraments, and they looked upon them in almost a superstitious way. And so Paul is saying, look, you fellows and gals, Israel had the sacraments. They were baptized, you might say, into Moses when they came through the sea. They had that food, that manna supplied in the desert, and that water supplied from the rock. They all of them ate and drank. All of them came out of the sea and through the sea in the Exodus, but with most of them. They had outstanding spiritual privileges, which all of them enjoyed, but not very many of them endured. Just because you have outstanding and many spiritual privileges does not mean that you will endure in the Christian life. It's more than just having those privileges. You need to be vigilant and on your guard. And that was what Paul was trying to get to them. And so he goes on to discuss that in verses 7 to 11. And he said, for instance, you need to realize that these situations that are recorded in Exodus and Numbers are examples for you folks at Corinth and Asquith. He mentions the Exodus 32 in verse 7, when right under the shadow of Sinai, Israel worshipped the golden calf. Then he mentions in Numbers 25, verse 8, when the Midianite and Moabite girl said to the Israelite boys, hey, why don't you come on over to our midweek service and worship Baal with us? And some of them did, and were involved in the sexual rites that went along with that. And so on, and there were 23,000 that fell as a result of the judgment for that. That's in Numbers 25. He said to them, don't put Christ to the test. That is, don't press him to the limit, as they did in Numbers 21, and the serpents were let loose who killed a number of the Israelites from their bites. And don't go on complaining, as some of them did, verse 10, were destroyed by the destroyer. That's in Numbers 16. Almost 15,000 Israelites died in a plague because they wouldn't quit disputing Moses and Aaron's leadership and so on. You can read it for yourself. But Paul's point here is not to go into detail so much as to say, look, here were people who had many privileges and yet who didn't endure, who didn't make it to the promised land. And so, therefore, he says to the people at Corinth, these things were written as a warning for us. Verse 11. Don't put this magical, superstitious confidence in the sacraments as though participation in the sacraments, in being baptized and having the Lord's Supper, makes some sort of invisible shield that nothing can affect you. And that's why he says to them, some of you need to be afraid. So then, let the one who thinks he stands take heed, watch out, lest he fall. He wants them to have an attitude of holy humility and reverent fear rather than pride. That's his concern. Now, how do we don't necessarily, perhaps, some of you may, I don't know, but perhaps our problem is not so much as we face the onslaughts in the Christian life, our problem may not be so much that we have a magical view of the sacraments, a sort of a superstitious view of them, but our superstition or our confidence can be misplaced in other ways. For example, sometimes you will meet someone or you'll hear somebody say, you know, I'm never going to really fall because I have great faith. Now, they may not say it in such crass fashion, but it almost comes out that way. You know, I really believe, etc. I know I believe in Jesus, and I and so on, and they tell you how much they believe because of such and such an experience or whatever. But if they do that, they're really showing you a little piece of idolatry. In what way? In that some people, when they say that, are essentially saying that they have great faith in their faith. And if you have faith in your faith, that's idolatry. We don't have faith in our faith. The only value of faith is that it clings to the almighty arm of God. It's the object of faith that gives faith any value at all. Be very careful that you're not going around putting faith in your faith, because you will be disappointed. Or there are some, you know, who will say, "Oh, I don't think I'll ever, if I don't have to worry. I don't have to be too careful about the watching the issues of my heart and being faithful to Christ or temptations or trials, because you see, the Lord has been gracious in giving me outstanding experiences of His power in my life. Why, I had a dramatic, spectacular conversion experience. I was really moved. It went to the overwhelming emotionally. Now I've never forgotten it." That's good. I hope you don't. And they will go on to say, "When I had this outstanding, almost miraculous answer to prayer, and this, I've just had so many experiences of God's power operating." And Paul would say to you, "Oh yes, the Israelites all had outstanding experiences of God's power. They went through the sea on dry land. And then they turned around and saw the Egyptians immersed and destroyed." Now that's a pretty outstanding spiritual experience. And they knew the experience of having water come out of a rock in the wilderness, and of going out every morning out of their tent and going out beyond the camp and picking up manna, the bread God gave to sustain them. They had outstanding experiences of God's power in their life, but with most of them, God was not pleased. Don't put your confidence in past experiences, even dramatic spiritual experiences of God's power. In other words, he is saying, there needs to be an attitude of humble, holy fear. Some of you need to be afraid. If anyone thinks that he stands, let him take heed, let him watch out, lest he fall. It's the city of Sardis you are familiar with from Revelation chapter 3. The city of Sardis in Asia Minor had a citadel, and that city that was in a huge mass of jutting rock was built on that or into it, and was thought to be impregnable. And Cyrus and Persians, I guess, were besieging Sardis, and Cyrus offered a reward to anyone who could find his way into that citadel. It so happened that one of Cyrus' men was watching one day, and one of the fellows in the garrison at Sardis accidentally lost his helmet. Goes tumbling down over the battlements, down, 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 down. And he saw this fellow come out of the citadel and carefully make his way down the particular way, picking his way down to retrieve his helmet, and then went back up. Cyrus' man watched him very carefully. And then that night, that soldier led a detachment of Persians up that very same path, over the battlements, into the citadel, and it was unguarded. Well, naturally it was, because you see, nobody could get into it anyway. It was impregnable. Let him who thinks he stands watch out lest he fall. You see, that was the proper kind of attitude in that note that was left on the door of John Newton's church where he served. You know, John Newton, the Amazing Grace writer of the hymn. A young man left a note on the door of Newton's church that said something like this: "A A young man has come into the possession of a considerable fortune and asked the prayers of the congregation that he may be preserved from the snares which it presents for him. There was the attitude. There was someone who knew that the only way he would stand would be if he was aware of his own weakness in order to find Christ's strength. And some of you need to be afraid. And then secondly, Paul says, some of you need to be assured. Verse 13. We could go into why Paul seems to put a word of assurance here right after verse 12. His main concern is to knock down the pride of the Corinthians. But we don't need to go into it so much. It just seems to be a word of assurance. He doesn't want them to have all fear or be overly distressed. And so he balances the word of warning with the word of assurance and comfort. And in verse 13 he says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to man or to men, to people, to humans, but God is faithful, etc. Now, what is Paul saying to them in this word of assurance? Well, he is saying to the Corinthians, first of all, your temptation is normal. Now, this word temptation that's used here, you've probably heard before, has a kind of an elastic kind of meaning. It can be what we usually think of as temptation, that is, a being seduced to evil, being drawn and trying to get us to succumb to wrong or to sin or to evil. That kind of temptation. It can also sometimes mean a testing or a trial, a more general use of the word. And Paul, I should think, probably intends both aspects here. You notice that he says, no temptation has overtaken you. It implies that temptations tend to grab you, that you struggle with them, that there's conflict. And you notice that there seems to be implied here, if temptations overtake you, you need to realize that temptation is not sin. Some people don't make that distinction. It's important that you do. Temptation is not sin. Jesus was tempted. There was no sin in being tempted. Temptation and testing is the common lot of God's people. The sin comes when we cuddle up to it, when we embrace it, when we ponder it, when we begin to debate it and think about it and are led to embrace it in such a way that we will act upon it. Then it becomes sin. But temptation in itself is not sin. Your temptation is normal, as indeed are all testing and trial, the common lot of us. And Paul is saying there's no supernatural thing here. This is not something unusual with you. It is the lot of all God's people. It is common to man. It's a human experience. But then Paul says something else in his word of encouragement, not just that your temptation is normal, that it's not going to be too much of an assurance. Most of us know that. But your God is faithful, and you may need to hear that again. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able to bear, but will make with the temptation also the way out, namely the ability to bear it. Now, what is Paul saying about how God is faithful? That's his main point. As you are tested, as you are tried, remember God is faithful. Well, he is saying God is faithful in that he limits the pressure of the temptation. He is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. Now take the word temptation there in the sense of an enticement to evil. What's Paul mean then? Well, he seems to mean this, that God will not make the pressure of an enticement to evil beyond what you can resist. He will never put you in a position where you will say, I had to sin. I had to. I had no other option. He will not put you in that position. But take the word temptation in the sense also of trial and of testing, a more general sense. And what is Paul saying there? Well, he seems to be saying that God will not allow the pressure of the temptation. He limits the pressure of it so that it won't be more than you're able to bear. Now, that makes us problems, and I'll tell you one reason why. It's because our standard of what we're able to bear can be lower maybe than God's. Isn't that what most of us think, or some of us do sometimes? You know, I've got these three major matters that I'm facing right now and I'm trying to get through. But if there's a fourth, that's going to be too much. I think we need to notice that Paul doesn't mean here that God will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we think we can bear, but beyond what we are actually able to bear. And that, of course, God himself alone knows. I don't want to say that to be unkind, just to try to get at the idea of the text. How often we have thought, right, that we couldn't take any more, and any more does indeed come. So we need to qualify that. Now, please notice what Paul does not say, however. Paul does not say that God will never allow us to be tempted. He does not say that. Paul does not say that God will not allow us to be tempted repeatedly. He does not say that God will not allow us to be tempted severely. He does not say that God will not allow us to be tempted extensively. But he says he will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we're able to bear. Now, I think I need to make a caution here in the use of this text. I guess it would be something like this. Use it more for yourself. Don't lay it as a Bible Band-Aid on others. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean about your own attitude. Be careful here. What I mean is this. Sometimes we can be very cruel in the way we try to comfort folks. And if you have a fellow, for instance, who has just had his house burned down last night and has lost his job this morning, and this afternoon his mother dies, don't go up to him and say, and we usually do it in a whining voice, right? Now, you know, says that God will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able to bear. I'll check back with you later. That kind of flippant, too easy, kind of intended well, perhaps, but it's too easy and flippant. They'll be ready to hear that. Maybe they'll see it themselves. But don't take it lightly. Don't do it in a cruel fashion. That's my concern. And yet at the same time, while saying that, I think we have to say something else here. That this is nevertheless true. And it's true because it's God's word. Isn't it true that oftentimes we have problems because we think God is laying more on us than we are able to bear, and we wonder? And so at such times we have to say, have you ever thought what God has not laid upon you? In the midst of the burdens you bear, have you ever thought, because you may think about it, you don't really know. Most of us don't know the things that God has kept from attacking and coming upon us. And Paul is saying, this is true, and we need to know that. Now then, what about the other part of God's faithfulness? Not only that he will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but also he is faithful in that he provides endurance within the temptation. So you have two aspects of God's faithfulness in this word of assurance. He limits the pressure of the temptation, and he provides endurance within the temptation. God is faithful. He will also make with the temptation the way out, namely the ability to bear it. Now, I've translated that differently, and you'll only find that translation probably in the New English Bible and the New Jerusalem Bible. Not the exact translation, but the same meaning. I don't know any other way to get at this than to kind of drag ourselves through the print and get dirty in it. But most translations will say something. He will, with the temptation, also make the way out in order that you may be able to bear it, as though that's the purpose of it. And that could be taken a couple of ways if it's translated that way. It could be taken this way, that with the temptation, God also makes the point when you're going to get out from under it and have relief, and therefore he does that in order that you'll be able to bear it. But if you're going to get relief, you won't be bearing it anymore. So that doesn't exactly jive. I suppose that you could say, if you translate it that way, the way it's usually translated, that it might mean that the believer knows that with the temptation, God will make the way of escape, and that since he knows that he makes the way out of it, or will, that makes him able to bear up under it as he goes through it until he gets to the way out, to the relief that God gives. That could be the meaning there. But this construction that Paul uses here is sometimes used, the last phrase of verse 13, is sometimes used when it wants to identify something. What do I mean by that? Well, as I translated it, God will also make the way out, namely. That is, he specifies what the way out is. And I think that is, without getting into arguing why we take that position, I think that's what is Paul's meaning here. With the temptation, God will also make the way out. What's the way out? Namely, the ability to bear or endure it. What's Paul saying then? Well, then he's saying that the way out is the way through. That the way God takes you out of the temptation is to make you able to bear up through it and leads you through it. Do we have any samples? Well, yes, back in verse 4, you know, Paul talked about that rock in Exodus 17 that the water came out of to supply the needs for the Israelites. And Paul says, picking up on that imagery, that the rock that followed Israel, he didn't think that there was an actual rock that followed them, but you know, rock is the term for Yahweh, for the Lord in the Old Testament. And he said, the rock that followed Israel, it's as if there was a rock that followed them all through the wilderness wanderings, and that rock was Christ. It was Christ himself who was really supplying water and food to the people of Israel all through their existence there. Now, that's something of what Paul... What was the way of escape for Israel? Well, it was going through the wilderness, where they came through the Red Sea, etc. They were delivered from Egypt, and where did they land? In the wilderness. And then the Red Cross helicopters came down, right? And they lifted all of them and brought them over the wilderness and into the promised land. Is that it? No, it didn't take them off over the wilderness. There are no helicopters in the Bible. Rather, he led them through the wilderness. That's elementary, I know. But that Paul seems to be getting at. Not that God makes an exit of the temptation or the trial, brings us out of it completely. Sometimes he may, other texts. We're just talking about this text. But in this text, he seems to say that the way out that God provides is the way through, namely the ability to bear it. That's what he gives. So that Paul is saying that in the midst of the temptation, God is faithful in that he provides endurance within the temptation until we come out of it. Now, that seems to be the idea behind an analogy that Charles Spurgeon, the British preacher, used, and it's a little quaint from the 19th century, but Spurgeon said, you know, when a shipwright builds a ship, he builds it. Well, he doesn't build it just to keep it on the scaffolding or on the stocks. No, he builds it for what? He builds it for the sea and for the storm. And when he's making the ship, he thinks of tempests and hurricanes. If he didn't, he would be a poor shipbuilder. And so Spurgeon goes on to say, when God made you a believer, he meant to try you. And when he gave you promises, he bade you trust them. He gave such promises as are suitable for times of tempest and tossing. Not that the tempest and the storm and the tossing suddenly cease, but that he makes your ship, as it were, able to endure the storm. And sometimes that's God's way out, the ability to endure. Well, those are two aspects of God's faithfulness: limiting the pressure of the temptation, providing endurance within the temptation, but above all, the center of your word of assurance in verse 13, stand out, and I hope stand out in neon with those few words, "But God is faithful." If you hold on to that, you will have enough. That was what I think Alan Cameron was saying, the Scottish Covenanter, in the dungeon in Edinburgh. And he didn't know that his son Richard had been killed at Erasmus. And one of the soldiers who had killed Richard Cameron and some of the others must have had a streak of utter cruelty, and he came by and opened the door to the dungeon of Alan Cameron, and he threw in a head and two hands. And he said as he yelled down, "Do you know whose these are?" And Alan Cameron took the bloody tokens on his lap, and he felt them. And he said, "Yes, they are my sons, my dear sons." And then he went on, "Good is the Lord, who could never wrong me or mine, and has made goodness and mercy to follow me all the days of my life." What was Alan Cameron really saying? Only what Paul said here. Took more words, but the same thing. He simply said, "Yes, they're my sons, my dear sons, but God is faithful." Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. You are not nearly as strong as you think. And God is far more faithful than you can imagine.